agenda, I understand we have visitors this afternoon. So I would like to recognize any of our interns from Texas Wesleyan. Y'all raise your hands back there. Okay, we're spread out around here. And then also we have visitors from Texas Tech, I believe, right? All right. Get those guns up. Anyways, we're happy to have all of you all here visiting with us.
We have one from the University of Texas also.
Oh, we do. Okay, great. And University of Houston. Well, the whole state is represented. Well, anyways, welcome this afternoon. We only have one case on our afternoon docket. It's Randall Mill Pharmacy versus Stacy Miller and Randy Miller. If the clerk will please announce counsel and, well, who's arguing today? Welcome. All right, Ms. Lunsford.
May it please the court. I want to thank you all for allowing me to make this argument. This is the first time I've appeared before this honorable court. I'll admit that I was in the Ninth Court last week, so it's been a summer of oral arguments. This is a very interesting case because I do all healthcare liability claims. And usually we're arguing about whether it's medical care in relation to that safety element, which is what I was arguing last week. But we all know, and I think the cases out there I know are extensive and I know courts are tired of them, but this one is a case of first impression, definitely. We know that the three elements of a healthcare liability claim are that the defendant must be a physician or a healthcare provider. And in this case, we know that the issue is pharmacy and pharmacists. And there are no cases that have interpreted that statute with the exception of the Ruiz case. And the Ruiz case that I cited in my brief basically says that if the action of the pharmacist deals with the prescription of or the dispensing or compounding or anything of prescription medications, then that is a healthcare liability claim. So plaintiff's argument or Appley's argument in this case is that the IV lipoic acid that was compounded by the appellants, that does not constitute a prescription medication. That's the sole argument in this case, and that's the issue to be decided. I think that it's important, and I thought it was very helpful. I think it was one of the only times that I've been able to file a reply brief and actually bring up new things, which, of course, is what the rules tell you to do, because there aren't a lot of, you know, cases or anything that interpret those issues. I think that we can look to what the appellees have admitted in their pleadings and their briefs, that they admit that appellants, and I'd like to quote, prepared a dietary supplement slash antioxidant in injectable form for Dr. Tan's use. And then they also say that appellants were providing a chemical substance, which is a dietary supplement in injectable form. There's no question that those are the facts. They are undisputed. So the question before the court is, was the providing of this IV dietary supplement a prescription medication?
Well, I have a question.
Sure.
Because this was prepared for Dr. Tan, it wasn't prepared specifically for the plaintiff, correct?
That's true.
So my question is, how can it be related to the plaintiff? How can the plaintiff have a health care liability claim when it wasn't even prepared for her? It wasn't for her health care. It was for Dr. Tan's office.
Well, indirectly, it was for her health care. There is a section of the pharmacy provisions or the laws regulating pharmacies that allow 5% of the drugs or medications to be used for office use. There's no question that it was distributed to Dr. Tan for use with his patients. I mean, plaintiffs actually,
But the suit isn't against Dr. Tan. The suit isn't against Dr. Tan for health care he provided.
Right, but the pharmacy provided health care through Dr. Tan because he ordered the medication. I understand that that's the distinction. There's no cases that distinguish whether that is not a health care liability claim, and I understand that's their argument. But it's sort of like if, you know, you were going to sue somebody that distributed something, you know, in the grocery store, and you're suing Procter & Gamble for something. Well, you didn't buy it from Procter & Gamble. You bought it from the grocery store. But you're allowed to sue Procter & Gamble, and
Right, but that's not a health care liability claim either.
Right, and there aren't any cases that deal with that indirect. And I understand that that's their argument, but how else, I mean, it's related to her health care, and that's my argument, is that the provision of this medication is related to her health care. It's for her health care. Dr. Tan was treating her hepatitis C, no question by any means about that. And it's not like he was just giving it to anyone, he was giving it to Stacy Miller. And he had prescribed that medication. This was, you know, there were 9 other times that he had done this, and that was prescribed for his office use, but for Stacy Miller.
But if a doctor prescribes, I'm using the word generically, I guess, vitamin B for a patient, does that make the vitamin B a prescription drug?
Well, I think so, because when I was looking up the definitions of what a drug is, you know, under the occupation code that regulates pharmacists, a drug is simply a substance intended for use in the diagnosis, cure, mitigation, treatment, or prevention of a disease. Well, I mean, my doctor prescribes baby aspirin for me. That's a drug. That's certainly a prescription drug. I mean, you can prescribe.
So you can't, well, isn't there a distinction between drugs that you can buy over the counter and drugs that are required to have a prescription?
There's no such distinction in the statute at all. And I would contend that in this situation, you couldn't buy the IV form of lipoic acid directly from the pharmacy anyway. It has to go through a physician because you're not allowed to administer your own IVs. I mean, unless they've allowed, you know, people to do that, you can't do it. I mean,
athletes do it.
Well, yeah, I don't even know if I want to get into that, step into that mess. But it's, you know, the compounding pharmacies a lot of times take oral medications that are over the counter, and they make it into something you can drink for people that can't swallow pills. Well, that's they're compounding of a drug or a medication. I mean, Advil's a drug. It's a medication. It's something we buy over the counter, but certainly there's nothing that says it's not a prescription medication if the doctor has prescribed its use. I think that's where we get into when I started looking at this, is there's no definition of prescription drug that requires it to be not something that's over the counter. I mean, it basically is.
It requires it to be a prescription, to have a prescription?
No, right. I mean, that requires it to be a prescription. I mean, the definition is basically the doctor's ordering it for the treatment of a health condition.
But then anything, you could have water being a prescription drug. If the doctor says, you know, your kidneys are really going and you need to drink 6 glasses of water. I mean, it could be that doesn't make sense.
Well, I could understand that if that was something you couldn't obtain water except from a physician, you know, giving it to you. In this case, the only way you can get this IV lipoic acid is to have the physician administer it to you in your office.
Is it the same thing as alpha lipoic acid?
I think that's what I understand. It's an amino acid, I think, that you can take. For various things, you know, sort of like, I think, vitamin D or, you know, one of those melatonin or something of that sort. But they take it and they make it into an IV form.
And the record, it sounds like, at least, does not contain a written prescription. But there was a telephonic order from the doctor's office to the pharmacy.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That's
okay, and was that telephone order, was it an order in bulk for his patients, or was it specifically stated that it was addressed for these plaintiffs or this plaintiff?
No, it was for office use.
Okay, for office
use. And they had provided it in the past for He administers it to a number of patients.
Is there something in the record that says I can't walk into a pharmacy and get the injectable form of this lipoic acid?
I'll admit to you, I know I always say it wrong, lipoic acid. I have to keep saying it to myself. There is nothing. And I even looked in what's been explained to me by my clients is that I said, how can you, you know, get an IV medication? I certainly can't go to Walgreens and buy it. Where's the law that says I can't get it? And it's sort of a weird, I mean, there isn't a law, but there's nowhere you can buy it, put it that way. I mean, that is the only way it can be administered is through a healthcare provider, like a physician. So what that was explained to me. Now, I think also the idea that in the record, there's all this evidence of the Texas Department of Health Services investigation, and they've investigated the pharmacy for this issue of providing it, you know, more than 5% in bulk quantities and not for a specific prescription, and they continue to refer to it as an IV prescription medication, and they wouldn't have authority to even regulate the pharmacy over that issue if it wasn't a prescription medication, because they don't have authority to do that. They have to have some authority for them to investigate it, and those records of the investigation are all attached in the file, and they're in the record by the plaintiffs themselves.
And they argue that just because there's going to be, at some point, if this case proceeds, expert medical testimony needed, that that does not morph it into a healthcare liability claim. But doesn't DiversiCare tell us it's a factor?
It is. In fact, that's one of the factors, and I addressed that in my brief. One of the main factors is that it requires expert testimony to prove it. And the only way they could prove, as you adequately or appropriately said, is that you'd have to be able to prove that that medication somehow caused the plaintiff's injuries, and you can't do that without an expert. I mean, my argument last week was on the slip and fall issue with the West Oaks case, which I informed the court I don't totally believe that holding, but I'm shocked that that's what it says. And, you know, the argument against that is the same thing. You don't need expert testimony when someone slips and falls in a hospital. And I agree, it's ridiculous to make that assumption, but unfortunately, that's what that case says. So in this, there has to be expert testimony, and that is one of the factors.
What type of expert testimony do you contend the report should contain?
In this one, there should be expert testimony from a pharmacist that says that the pharmacy breached the standard of care in the compounding of that medication. And then there has to be causation testimony that that breach, that, you know, problem with the medication caused Stacey Miller's damages. That's absolute. There would have to be both of those elements. They could do it to, you know, two or three reports. We all know that. But you have to have both of those elements in the report. I did sort of a survey of all of the cases that have held that there was health care liability claim these days, just, you know, as a sort of a summary for the court. I mean, it's pretty amazing to me that when you provide an amputated toe of another patient instead of fetal remains, that that's considered a health care liability claim. Or the death of a nursing home patient from a spider bite is a healthcare liability claim. Or a doctor's actions in negligently advising a water park on the use of defibrillators, you know, that's healthcare liability claim. I'm very familiar with the defective footboard in the St. Luke's Hospital because I filed the motion for rehearing in that case. So then we have DiversiCare, sexual assault of the patient, and the list goes on and on. It seems very hard for me to make the argument that the providing of an IV medication to a doctor for use with a patient in the treatment of a healthcare condition is not a healthcare liability claim. I can't believe that that's what the legislature intended. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Lunsford. Mr. Minton.
May it please this honorable court, counsel, Mr. Fitzgerald. if I pause in my presentations because I'm flipping back and forth between iPad apps, so it's not because I don't know what I'm talking about. I want to address, first of all, something Justice Walker raised initially, and that is the necessity of expert testimony. Look, any personal injury case you try, there's going to have to be expert testimony to link up the medical with the damages and causation. That doesn't make every car wreck into a health care liability claim. If we were talking about, counsel gets ahead of herself because she says, well, there'd have to be evidence, there'd have to be expert testimony about the standard of care. There would be if it was a health care liability claim. This isn't a health care liability claim. This is a claim about an adulterated substance, whatever adulterated it, whether it's sand, broken glass, or whatever. We're talking about an adulterated product prepared in bulk for a physician who, he's the one that decided, if this case was about the efficacy of treating Hep C with lipoic acid and it was against Dr. Tan, yeah, I'd concede you probably have to have an expert report at that point in time. But when we're talking about a non-prescription medication that the doctor, you know, if a doctor calls up and says, I want lipoic acid in an injectable form. Okay. I don't think that the fact that it's in injectable form necessarily makes a difference. I seem to remember, I don't remember if it was the 70s or the 80s, but there was kind of a fad where people would inject themselves with B12. I mean, they could buy the needles, and they either did it themselves or their partner did it. I know I couldn't do it to myself, but people do it all the time.
People with diabetes inject insulin every day.
Sure, but that's a whole different ball of, that's a whole different issue, because I think insulin is, you know, because it has to be monitored so closely. But the fact that it's in an injectable form, or that you don't have to go to a doctor to have it administered. Years ago, my wife and I went through infertility treatments, and I had to give her shots for 6 weeks. We didn't have to go to the doctor's office to do it. So all those statements, those are kind of a red herring. The fact that it's IV as opposed to being in a powdered form, there really is. I mean, if you think of this the way you would think of injectable B12, it's the same thing. Is it a drug? Okay, maybe it's a drug, but is it a prescription drug? And if you go back to the Texas Occupations Code, and this is where I'm switching applications, so bear with me. When they talk about, there is a specific, and they call it a prescription drug. Chapter 74, the definition of pharmacist, makes reference to prescription medication or prescription medicine. But if you go back to the definitions in Section 55.1.003 of the Texas Occupations Code, a prescription drug, this is subsection 36. Prescription drug means a substance for which federal or state law requires a prescription before the substance may be legally dispensed to the public, or B, a drug or device that under federal law is required before being dispensed or delivered to be labeled with the statement, caution, federal law prohibits dispensing without prescription or prescription only, or caution, federal law restricts this drug to use by or on the order of a licensed veterinarian. We're not dealing with that. Or a drug or device that is required by federal or state statute or regulation to be dispensed on prescription, or that is restricted to use by a practitioner only. Well, lipoic acid isn't restricted to a practitioner only. The injectable form, I guess, is restricted to use by a practitioner simply because you got to have somebody, whether it's the doctor or his nurse, to inject you with it. But the limitation is not the result of the statute. It's a result of the nature or the form in which the substance is administered. I also want to emphasize that there was no written prescription in this case. This was a telephone order. Dr. Tan might as well have just picked up the phone and said, hey, can you put together a batch of Flintstone vitamins for me, or cough drops or something like that. The example that I gave in my brief, it's a little ridiculous about the rancid chicken soup, but it makes the point. There, pharmacists sell a lot of things. You go to Walgreens and you can practically do all your grocery shopping there. But what, again, it comes back down to the statute. This is the one time in my career that I've actually seen the Texas Medical Liability Act work to my advantage. It's different than the Ruiz case. And let me explain why the Ruiz case is inapplicable here. The Ruiz case was decided under the old statute, the Texas Medical Liability Insurance Improvement Act, the statute that had its genesis way back in 1978. That case, or in that case, there's one footnote to the case, and let me find my notes so that I can quote it here. A pharmacist was a healthcare provider. It defined a pharmacist as a healthcare provider. It defined it as, quote, any pharmacist acting in the course and scope of his employment. Now, maybe if that statute was still around, they might have a point. But Chapter 74 changed all that. If there was any vestige of common law healthcare liability, even under the old statute, it was destroyed by the new act. And when you look at the new statute, you see the definition of a pharmacist. It is solely his liability under the chapter. And keep in mind, unlike a physician, just about any claim against a physician, short of him rear-ending you in an automobile, is a healthcare liability claim because of who he is and what he does. But a pharmacist, it's not who he is, it's what he does. Is he dispensing prescription medication? And in this case, you have to say no.
What about this Texas West Oaks Hospital case, which is an interpretation and a maybe broadening because of the statute's change in the word from patient to claimant?
What I understood that case to say is that, you remember, in healthcare liability claims, the argument used to be, well, you didn't have a physician-patient relationship, or you didn't have a pharmacist-patient relationship. What I understand that case to mean, and I did not read that case before coming here, but what I understood that to mean was that case actually, it broadened the class of people who could bring a healthcare liability claim, and I think also basically kind of did away with the physician-patient relationship practically, if not legally. And my recollection, I'm a little behind on the facts of the case, but that would be, as I recall the case, that's basically what I understood that case to mean, which is why I didn't argue in my brief that there was no pharmacist-patient relationship. There isn't any relationship, pharmacist-patient or otherwise. The only relationship was between Dr. Tan and Mrs. Miller, and it was his treatment, that we're not, as far as contesting the efficacy of that, that's not an issue here. The issue is, what was she provided? And what was she told or not told about what she was provided? I do want to address one argument that they have made in response with regard to the investigation by the Texas Department of Health. You have that in full in the record. Of course, the commission found that there was no evidence that this was issued under prescription whatsoever. But the important part is what the agency chooses to call a prescription drug. I have to presume that these people at the agency are all good folks and they're trying to do their job. But what this is a backwards effort to try to argue that the court should give deference to an agency definition or an agency interpretation of a statute. At least I think that, and that's being pretty generous as far as their characterization, but that rule, if it applies, only applies in a situation where you have an ambiguous statute, and even then the court is not bound to follow the interpretation of the agency. I mean, we use terms like drugs all the time. Is it a drug or is it a vitamin? Well, you know, but the fact that the agency may call it that in the course of its investigation, the final arbiter of the meaning of the statute, because it is a question of law, rests with the court, not with an administrative agency or an administrative agency's investigators.
Does there have to be a written prescription in order for a drug to be a prescription drug? Don't doctors sometimes call in prescriptions while their patients are sitting there in the examining room? And
they do.
Through the drugstore.
But again, here the distinction is, this was not something that you know, when my doctor calls in a prescription for me to my pharmacy, you know, they call it in for me. I have to go up there and identify myself by name. And, you know, that telephone message is probably every bit as effective as a paper script written by the healthcare provider. But we don't have this in this case. This is no different than if he said, send over a couple of cases of rubbing alcohol so I can give injections. That's the difference here. It's a telephone order. It's just like a telephone order. Well, again, I don't mean to lapse into absurd examples, but it's like a telephone order for a pizza. It involves a different subject matter, but I don't think it constitutes a telephone prescription. No, you can do that, but again, you're prescribing it for a particular person.
Thanks.
This is, to say that this is somehow or another related to healthcare, okay, I understand the definition of a healthcare provider. Basically, our whole argument is you don't even get to healthcare provider because you're not dealing, because of the limited, circumscribed, narrow instant in which a physician is a healthcare provider, he has to be prescribing a prescription medication. We don't even get there because this is not a prescription medication. To say that it's related to healthcare, well, you know, you can make arguments that all kinds of things people supply are related to healthcare. But I think what is important for the court to keep in mind is when they did away with the old act, where all you had to do to be a pharmacist was act in the course and scope of your employment, and they passed a new statute with a more narrow definition, which says that you have to be in the course. The precise language is in the statute. I have it, but I'm not going to flip back and forth to read it. But where the precise language of the statute is dispensing prescription medicines, and you don't have a prescription, I think that's important. I think that's an important distinction because the legislature realized that pharmacists these days, you know, they sell over-the-counter medications, they sell prescription medications, they sell hair dryers, and they sell eggs, depending on the store. So I think that that was an effort. I think that the legislature realized that the earlier definition was too broad because you sell somebody a hair dryer that sets your house on fire. Is that a health care liability claim?
But isn't there a distinction here, though, because there is a compounding that takes place by the pharmacist at the pharmacy, presumably. Doesn't that make it a little factually different from the hair dryer or?
It does make it different, and it may make it a drug in the sense that aspirin is a drug, in the sense that B12 is a drug, but does that make it a prescription drug? I mean, presumably, you know, a doctor could have manufactured it himself. I don't know. But the fact that he went to a compounding pharmacy and he made them, that they made basically what amounted to a mixture of probably what was a powder. Thank you. A saline solution. I think that makes a distinction. I was also handed a note. I hope I get it right, but this is direct liability against the pharmacist as opposed to pass-through liability under 402A of the Restatement of Torts. You know, the doctor orders injectable lipoic acid. But the issue is, well, does that lipoic acid have ground glass in it? Does it have sand in it? Does it have some kind of contaminant in it? I mean, the doctor didn't want ground glass and lipoic acid. He wanted lipoic acid, and that's what he got.
All right, Mr. Minton, your time is up. Would you like to give us your prayer?
Your Honor, my prayer is this, and that is that the court affirm the trial court's denial of the motion to dismiss.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Minton.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Lunsford.
I think a lot of really good points were brought up, and I think I want to go back to, I think it's important to go back to the definitions of exactly what the section that we're talking about, a healthcare liability claim, is. And it says specifically the definition of a pharmacist contained in the healthcare liability statute is one licensed under Chapter 551 Occupations Code who, for the purposes of this chapter, performs those activities limited to the dispensing of prescription medications. Again, then go back to Chapter 551. What is a prescription medication? I mean, it even talks about compounding, and then it talks about specifically that a medication order, it's that the pharmacist, one of their duties is to interpret and evaluate prescription drug orders or medication orders. And that's where we get into, because it is broader than just a drug or something of that sort. It says medication order means an order from a practitioner or practitioner's designated agent for administration of a drug or device. Nowhere in the statute does it say for a specific patient. It says an order from a practitioner, Dr. Tan, for a drug or device, which was the lipoic acid. He talked a little bit about that this was an adulterated, you know, substance, that's what they were going at. But you need to look back on their pleadings, because I think that's important. One of the allegations is a lack of informed consent, that we didn't give them the warnings about the lipoic acid. So it's not just a cause of action for an unadulterated device. Also, you know, the original petition, and I know we don't go totally because we look at what the nexus of the claim is, talks about the fact that they gave notice under Chapter 74. You know, in the Aguirre case that I was counsel for, appellant in that case also out of Corpus Christi, that was a factor that the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals used in determining whether the claim being made by the plaintiff was a healthcare liability claim.
What was a factor?
Whether the notice letter, the fact that the plaintiff gave a notice letter under Chapter 74 to the healthcare provider, in that case was a methadone clinic.
So you're saying that the plaintiff can determine whether or not it's a healthcare liability claim by whether or not they give notice?
I'm saying that is a factor that the court can consider in determining that was the nexus of the complaint. Because part of the issue, and I pointed that out, was the informed consent. One of their allegations is not just that this was an adulterated substance, but that the pharmacy, my client, didn't give adequate warnings about the use of the lipoic acid. That isn't a healthcare liability claim. I don't know what is. The case is specifically.
Here's the real crux of the issue, is that if this had been provided, if lipoic acid, say it was the plaintiff could come in there and buy it, right? Then it's not a healthcare liability claim. If there's no doctor involved, it's not a healthcare liability claim, period, right?
I don't believe that's the case. I believe that if it is considered a prescription medication, that if the plaintiff bought a prescription, say it was just from the pharmacy, that like aspirin, I think that would be considered a healthcare liability claim.
So all the tainted Tylenol cases are healthcare liability claims?
They aren't, again, there's no, they were always suing Tylenol as opposed to suing the pharmacies, so I don't know that we can even go there. I mean, it depends on whether, say, a better example is, say they took the Tylenol and they squashed it all up and made it into a liquid form because somebody couldn't take the pills. I think that's a healthcare liability claim, according to the statute. There aren't any cases. This is a case of first impression. So, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Lunsford and Mr. Minton. Mr. Fitzgerald, we appreciate you being here. We do appreciate all your briefing in this quite interesting legal issue. Your case is now submitted. That being our only case on our docket, we will adjourn court now. Thank you.